So yeah, we've been talking about whole health this week and thinking about it a little bit differently. And the tradition and simplicity piece has come up, but we haven't really like named it within our discussions. We talk about practicing some of the ancient traditions, but also family traditions and making our own traditions about wellness and our choices for our family, for ourselves. And the simplicity part of that is, you know, our bodies are intricate and complex, but caring for our bodies doesn't have to be, and there are simple ways to do that without spending a lot of money, without, making it too complicated. So the new posture title, actually, Todd came up with that, and it wasn't on purpose, but I kind of grabbed hold of it and decided that's a great name for a workshop. So we were in this town called Claremont, which is about 15 miles from my house, and it's a college town. There's five colleges in like a 1.5 square mile place, and it has a very Ivy League kind of feel. It's pretty prestigious. Very much a university town, and college town. And there's a lot of like great shops and restaurants and a lot of open space and places to just walk and hang out and a little independent theater. And so we were, we were out in the courtyard just kind of watching people, which is also fun to do. And just after a while of doing that, he's like, look, the new posture. And it was this. Mm-hmm. And it just struck me, and I'd already been, and he knew that I'd been studying about screen time and all that, and it was so true, because you just started to look around, and even when people are with each other, it's like this. So it was just, that's where the title came from.
I saw a great cartoon that had a person with one of those dog collars, like an up.
Uh-huh.
And somebody's looking at him like what's that about? And so I don't look at my phone every 2 seconds.
Oh, that's funny. The cone of shame.
The cone of shame.
Yeah. And then I just wanted to read this another quote from Wendell Berry. This was something he had written about in 1988 when his editor was trying to get him to buy a computer. So he's an essayist and has written some short stories and poetry and that sort of thing. So this is kind of his response to that. He says, we know that the desirability of technological innovation is an issue that requires thinking about, and we should have acquired some ability to think about it. Thus, if I'm partly a writer, and I'm offered an expensive machine to write, I ought to ask whether or not such a machine is desirable. I should ask in the first place whether or not I wish to purchase a solution to a problem that I do not have. I acknowledge that as a writer, I need a lot of help, and I have received an abundance of the best help from my wife, from family, from friends, teachers, editors, and sometimes readers. But a computer, I'm told, offers a kind of help you can't get from other humans. A computer will help you write faster, easier, and more. Do I then want to write faster, easier, and more? No. My standards are not speed, easy, and quantity. I have already left behind too much evidence that, writing with a pencil, I have written too fast, too easily, and too much. I would like to be a better writer, and for that, I need help from other humans, not a machine. And I like that, and I have pored over that, and the few things that I pull out of it is the same things that I think that we ought to be doing when all this new technology keeps coming out, and it's faster, and it's smaller, or whatever, however it better helps us. But he thought about it, and this is where intentional living happens. We think about things before we just impulsively purchase things. And he asked if there was a problem with the current way he was writing. Is there a problem with the current phone you have? So my daughter gave me this really great gift for Christmas, and it's a new case for a newer phone. I'm like, have never said that I was gonna upgrade or me to upgrade my phone, and so I can't even use this thing unless I get this new phone. So it was kind of this funny, here it is almost Christmas again. And she's like, why didn't you upgrade? I'm like, well, my phone's fine. But anyway, then he considered his standards. And I think that that's something we ought to revisit every so often. What are my standards, especially when we're going to make a purchase in technology? And then the last thing was, he asked himself, do I desire or need the technology in question? So that's my brief presentation. But what I'd like to hear, and some of you have been here much longer than others, is considering this area and the limitations, the internet limitations, not just the access, but the speed, the lack of cell phone connection service, and whatever other limitations you find you run into. How have you adapted to that? Like really tangible ways that you've adapted? And then with what have you replaced time you would have spent at home in front of a screen? So if you had been home and you had all this time and you had access and you had fast internet and all that, what are you doing here that you're doing differently because you don't have that? Did I make myself clear, I hope?
In the last couple of years, I really try to wean myself off television to the point now where even when it's available, I never turn on the television just because of the marketing and the, you know, the dramatized news just traumatize me, make me upset, and I just do not listen to it or watch it. So up here, I'm well suited up here. I found that I do like to watch YouTube because I can watch what I want, when I want, and I don't have to watch any of the politics or any of the marketing, or I can look the other way till the YouTube, you know, where you hit the skip button.
Yeah.
And I found that I really enjoy watching a lot of educational YouTube type things or things I'm interested in studying. And what I found up here is because of the decrease in bandwidth, I can't watch YouTube. So I actually started reading more, and but of course, you know, I got enough books. I got like 5 boxes of books here, you know. But so I do the Kindle Reader, you know, and yeah, it takes a little while to get it, or I download it when I'm down late, and then I come back in. And so I find myself reading a lot more, and actually I find it much more peaceful, I find it harder to fall asleep reading like an iPad than reading a book, physical book,
yeah.
The light kind of.
I have 3 adopted kids, and they're 27, 25, and 22. And they've all had really bumpy adolescent, early teens, or early 20 and late 20 lives. And the way I connected with them before I came up here was instant messaging, texting, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. And it was really hard for me initially when I got here. And I called it my cacophony of connection. It was like there was an addiction. I would wake up in the morning and look to see who I got emails from or texts or Facebook stuff, and then respond to them. And sometimes they were my kids, sometimes they weren't. And it was hard to come up here and not have that connection because that generation doesn't write letters. And they might make a phone call, but they can't do that either. So it's been really tough for me to do that. And I've just been writing letters more. And when I can, I might Facebook them and up here. But it was, I loved that Wendell Berry thing because he got really clear about why they would like him to get a computer. And what I realize is that for the computer, for me, and I'm not in on front of it even when I'm out very much, was a way of connecting. And so coming up here, writing letters is now a way to connect. When I get down lake, I'll make phone calls, that kind of thing. But it was a way of connecting, and I'm still trying to figure out how to do that.
Are they writing back?
Oh, no.
No. If I get a letter, I will be really surprised. Really surprised.
Hi, my name is Todd. It's been 6 days since my last text.
Todd, we're glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm experiencing withdrawal symptoms, though. And what I've noticed is that I think I went from I had the phone in my pocket the previous job that ended 1st of August. It would buzz 150 to 200 times a day. And the nature of the job was such that I couldn't not look at them. I didn't have to immediately respond to all of them, but you had to give it that triage to look at that. Mm-hmm. And I think in the time that I've left that job before I came up to Holden, I still had that habit of just checking it a lot. And so what I didn't realize is how many of those were phantom buzzes. Because since I've been up here, it's like there's been moments where it's like, oh, it's a, no, it can't be. So I
was hoping, but it's not.
So I think I've kind of learned that I've still, you know, there's without the need, without any expectation from anybody to be looking at it and checking it and all that kind of stuff, I've still been checking. And so kind of the thing I've learned here is just that habit that was there. I didn't really realize I had it much.
Speaking of the phantom buzz, I've been here for 13 months, and I mean, it's not something you think about, but it just happened. I had a twinge in my leg right when I thought it was, you know, a couple weeks ago. First thing I thought, it was like, oh, it's my phone. I was like, wait, that doesn't make sense to me at all. I make fun of people that come up here and, like, work, and, like, why is your phone always in your pocket? Like, are you using that? Or, like, I don't carry my wallet, so now when I go out, having those things in my pocket just drives me nuts. I crochet, certainly, you know, to build that, like, anxious time. When we go out, I never turn on the TV. Mostly, if it's not a brand new TV, it makes this crazy noise. I'm like a dog, and I don't like the way it sounds, but it's kind of nice not having that white noise in the background other than music. I enjoy music and noise in the background.
Yeah. The first session, there were about, I don't know, 3 women knitting. And I love it. And it's like, I don't see that anywhere else but at Holden. People knitting during church, people knitting during, you know, the first time I came up was winter and we wrote the red box. And I remember Scott McConnell knitting, like, never seen a man knitting before. We're not going. And it's just, I love it. I mean, and I've tried it, and I've learned how to cast on, and I even learned how to purl, but I always mess it up. And anyway, did you know how to, what are you doing? Yeah, Riley?
I'm making a headband out of leftover weaving yarn.
Okay.
But
a knitting thing?
It's essentially like, same knots that you would make for like a friendship bracelet.
Okay. Did you know how to knit before you came up here?
Well, this is crochet.
Okay.
Ruth is gonna teach me to knit eventually when I have time or finish whatever this is. So maybe.
Okay. Anything else before we
I get trails? Your question made me think of a couple of things. One is when we go out, I get really frustrated with the rest of my family. Mm. I don't think I've told them this. Because my kids and my husband both, like, until they get caught up with the Daily Show, I don't see them. And so they're glued to a screen for, you know.
You mean the show that is?
Yeah, they watch it on the computer. So, yeah, a screen. Yeah, and so, anyway, so that was one thing that your question made me think of. And then the other was, I don't know, it was a year after we moved here or something. Anyway, I had an iPad, and we were down lake, and it got stolen. And the thing that I noticed after I came back to Holden was that I had been playing Scrabble or... you know, word game or something on the iPad previous to that, but then when I didn't, and we didn't replace it because we chose not to or whatever, and then I read more or, I enjoyed the other things more than Scrabble.
I'm sort of getting sucked into that one. I'm at that point in my life, I guess, when I'm not sleeping very well a lot of times. And when I wake up and I'm sort of like my mind gets going, I look for something to basically soothe myself. And usually I have my phone in the vicinity and a book in the vicinity. And I use the phone as an alarm clock, so that's its primary function, I guess. But it's become a secondary function to play, you know, Crib Against the Computer or Solitaire or Words with Friends, those kinds of things. And it's harmless enough, except that when it becomes a habit and you find yourself sort of doing it unconsciously, or, you know, I read a study that said that for people today, between the artificial light and the screen time, and the fact that we're all reading Kindles or phones or whatever, especially late at night, that if you go camping, it takes like 4 days to reset your biorhythms. And I often wonder what it would be like if I disciplined myself and didn't turn on a light. I got up to go to the bathroom or whatever, and I made a point of doing that. I wonder if my sleeping habits would be better. It's one of those things where that's a question for me about me, but there it is.
Well, it's not that that's going to be actually one of the findings, but I justify my time spent on computer word games by calling it brain health, brain exercise or something, but I don't really know if it is. I mean, Lumosity is kind of the big brain, you know, for your brain, health for your brain, and I don't know if anybody's been on it, but I did the assessment, which is free, of course. And I'm like, really? Wow. You know, and you select areas that you want to improve, like whether it's cognitive or memory or attention or whatever it is, and then they give you these games. And it's pretty fun, and I did it, and of course then I'm, you know, hammered with all these ads to sign up and pay and all this. But so, yeah, interesting. I know for me, just the few times I've been up here, they've all been pretty brief. I think 5 weeks was August. It was refreshing to me to just unplug. And I mean, I check email and, you know, want to know what my daughter's doing and how she's doing. Did she burn the house down or not? But I got out on the trails and it was just great. And not just the physical, but just the spiritual side of creation and prayer and, you know, relieving whatever tension and that sort of thing. So it's great to be back.
You know, one thing that has been discussed here is trying to bring in, you know, faster internet so that, you know, you don't have to spend half your day waiting, you know, to do a broadband microwave link or something like that. And it is feasible to do that, although it's expensive. But the greater question that, you know, the board and the people thinking about it are looking at is, do you want to, take away the remoteness? It's kind of like Paradise Lost. Yes, you're getting something for it, but you're also, like you said, when you actually are forced to not have it, or when I went on vacation from my boss, you know, and what do you mean I can't call you? What do you mean that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And to say, sorry, I'm on vacation for a week, you know, you have to live without me and wait for a week to call me.
So let's look at these findings. Once again, I didn't print enough, but and a lot of the research on screen time right now is kind of centered around kids and their developmental stages and that sort of thing. But I really think they're just as important for us to look at as adults. About screen time, not just the obvious that it consumes a lot of our time, but it also just drains us of our mental energy. And it can make us really sensitivity of what's right in front of us.
Any extras
over there? Sorry. Does everybody have access to, like,
the nice?
Oh,
okay.
Only your email.
Yeah, just send it to my phone and then it's good.
And so there's that piece of the way it distracts us from what's right in front of us and the mental energy that it kind of sucks out of us. But there's also this idea that, you know, everything we take in audio and visually shapes us. It helps us tell our story, helps us or hurts us. And it feeds our soul. It either, you know, damages our soul or nurtures our soul. And that I think that we need to be thoughtful of that. I'm not anti-technology, I just want to make that clear.
I think developmentally it's at risk too, because I think most two-year-olds, or a lot of two-year-olds, unless people are really intentional about their use of technology around two-year-olds, are gravitate toward the computer and your phone. If you get your phone out, they're like, my niece when she was 2.5 could take pictures with my phone. And she's like, can you download some games?
Yeah.
Where'd you learn this?
They
know.
Yeah.
And it's because how much time do their parents spend staring at it instead of making Facebook on?
Yeah, that's the old tradition. I mostly think about how it impacts our social life. It's just my inclination is to that. But there's also quite a few, there's a couple at least of, like you said, the light. There's this one that light can interfere with the natural rhythm of your metabolic hormones. And some of these were new to me. Actually, let's just read through them because I think seeing them on paper and hearing them helps us remember them. So maybe, Peter, you could start with the first one and we just go through the front row here.
Repeated exposure to screen violence may make us less sensitive towards victims of human suffering.
It can impact our ability to read nonverbal cues, such as body language and facial expression. This can cause problems in relationships.
Secrecy.
Consumerism, screen media are businesses that thrive on materialism.
The light can interfere with the natural rhythm of metabolic hormones.
Orthopedic issues, I added. Is that you added?
I added that one.
Conversation and interaction at meals is compromised.
Screen time can interfere with exercise, nutrition, and sleep.
Yeah.
The nutrition one, I was a health coach before I came here. And one of the things that I was so aware of is that when you eat in front of the TV, and there's lots of studies, but that you eat a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
You're not even really aware of how much you're eating.
Oh, yeah.
You're just glued to the TV and you're eating and eating and eating. And so that was one of the things we taught people. Don't eat in front of the TV.
Gosh, that's hard.
Yeah.
Especially when, like, my daughter lives with me, but she's gone a lot. And so I'll be, you know, eating by myself. No one's done this, right? So writing on the computer, you know, finally, like, okay, I gotta get off the computer. So make something to eat. Turn on the TV. Check myself. You know, I've got my cell phone right here. So just move from one screen or more than one screen to another, and before you know it, like, a couple hours have passed, and you haven't gotten away from the screen.
What am I supposed to do? Just sit and eat?
I know, and you have this illusion, I have this illusion that there's company in the room or something when the TV is on, you know.
Get it on.
And I don't watch, I'm not a binge watcher of things, which is a whole other kind of trend now, but you know, I like the news, I don't mind the bad news, I mean, I think it's important. But so anyway, yeah. So I'm curious, how many of these can you personally relate to? And if you have any sort of examples or experiential contribution here, it would be great.
How about adding?
Sure. This is actually just one research paper that I happened to find. I'm sure there's plenty more, except for the thing I added.
I find that if I watch television, when I'm done, I feel kind of like I slept in or slothful, and I feel like this kind of depression, you know, and the only way to make that go away is to go watch some more, you know? and so it becomes like an addiction, you know, where you keep on watching because you don't want to feel that, you know, whatever that post-television depression is,
yeah.
You know? Like, you just wasted the whole day,
mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, I think that's a little bit of the spiritual, you know, type reaction.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Chris?
Well, the one about, where I guess when I came to Holden, I was thinking, that'd be great, you know, get away from all the screen stuff. And what I found is that as far as my work goes, I'm, you know, probably my least favorite communication form is email. I prefer the phone than email. But if I'm, you know, I'm on the screen a lot for work.
Yeah.
But one thing that I do think we gain here at Holden is that when we're talking to somebody at the dinner table or whatever, they're not constantly checking
mm-hmm.
their electronic device. When we get together with somebody's brother and sister-in-law and whatever, I mean, it is downright annoying because you can never carry on a conversation. You know, you're at the table and the phone is under the table and they're texting, and they may even be texting each other while you're at around the table.
Mm-hmm.
Talking, you know, it's just you want to grab the phone and throw it out the window and say, "Well, let's be present here."
There's a gentleman who was in like the Silicon Valley for 20 years, very much involved in computer programming, whatever. And after 20 years, he sort of shifted gears, and now he's doing this. He's teaching people to have healthy screen
time.
Hmm?
Unplug.
I don't remember his name, but his website is digitaldetoxing.com,
mm-hmm.
and there's a really funny, totally hyperbolic video of a guy and a girl having a meal together, and it's just funny, and I don't know, I knew I would probably be able to show it, but it's just to the extreme where she's talking, and first he just answers his cell phone, and he puts it away, and then he's talking. She continues talking, and then the next thing you know, he's playing solitaire. It's all just one thing after another. He's just doing all these different activities, but not listening to her. But it's really about, you know, turn off your cell phone. I think it's like, turn it off or something. But it's a great website that has a lot of good articles, too. And they're just kind of short articles that kind of touch on that issue.
There's a short film called I Forgot My Phone. Have you seen it?
No.
I think it's excellent. So this woman made it, and it shows her in all these different social situations without her phone. And so they're at the bar, you know, for 20-somethings, and she doesn't have a phone, and she's talking, and then she notices that no one is listening to her anymore because something is beeped or, you know,
mm-hmm.
buzzed, and, oh, my Words with Friends turn is up, you know.
Yeah.
And I can't even remember. They're just four or five different things where if no one had a phone, it would be fine.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I was going to comment about the violence. I have two young boys, and I worry about video games, so I have rules about what video games they can play. And just Nico, my oldest, was really angry with me because I wouldn't let him play a game. They have these games, they're first-person shooters. It's where you're like the guy holding the gun. But he knew he was never going to play one of those. But there's one, it's sort of a cartoony version, but you're still, it's still your eyes, and you're shooting at cartoons, and there's no blood. And I said, yeah, but you're still the person, it's you destroying the zombies or whatever it is. Well, but it doesn't matter. It does matter.
So they're finding that it really does matter. So
yeah,
So I used to think one of the saddest things I ever saw was like a mom and a child, or a dad and a child, at a restaurant, and the parent constantly on the phone. I thought that was probably the saddest thing I ever saw. Now what I see, because of these guys, is parents taking their kids to the playground, and their kids are playing on the equipment, and they're on the phone. I just think that is so sad. And what they found, they've done a few little studies on that, and what they have found is that the kids are feeling less.
I keep thinking of this scene in Hook, and maybe you've all seen it, when Robin Williams' Hook, and he's really busy with his career, and his wife says to him, "You are missing it." Their kids, childhood, and he looks at her, and the phone rings, and he grabs the phone, and she grabs the phone and throws it outside. You guys remember that scene? It's like one of my favorite scenes.
Isn't it about Peter Pan?
Yeah, he was actually, yeah. It's a good movie to watch. It'd be fun to watch. Look,
I think we've showed it.
Oh, here.
But, I mean, but not recently.
But it was, I keep remembering that scene, because what she says is, "You are missing it," and that's kind of what you're saying. The phone is making us miss being in the present moment. And what are we missing in that present moment? And is it worth it?
It's right in front of you. It's not like,
This is maybe off topic, but you don't need electronics to miss the present moment.
True.
I have a friend who always talks about his father being behind the newspaper.
Right.
You know, so at his house, there was just the newspaper.
Right.
Because he couldn't handle his crazy mom. But, you know, that's neither here nor there.
Right.
So,
that's a way of checking out. There are lots of ways to check out.
There are lots of ways to check out.
Well, in the olden dinosaur age, it was the television.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, but that was the olden days. Like, way back. That's almost next to the cave now.
You know, in the book The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, he talks about how happiness needs to be in the moment. Any time that our mind is wandering into the future or the past, you know, we actually take ourselves away from that. So one of the things that I moved away from television, I started to try to go live life. And one of the things I did was, you know, I ride motorcycles. And I'm riding a motorcycle. You can't be daydreaming, and you can't be thinking about your grocery list, because you have to be in the moment at the time, especially if you're riding in big groups, you know, where, you know, you've got all these big, huge 1,000-pound machines moving around you, and you got to kind of stay in your spot and stuff. Actually, I found that it was really good meditation to stay in the moment. And by detaching, turning off the TV and stuff like that, and going out and surfing or riding my motorcycle or hiking or whatever, kind of puts me into the moment, into the zone, and that's where I find happiness. I don't find happiness in a machine or whatever. Kind of more like a frustration or a depression that comes from it. But that's all.
What does it mean, secrecy?
Yeah. So part of what I do when I'm at home, I mentor a couple of girls who I met when they were in the eighth grade, and now they're in the senior in high school. It's part of our youth group where you sort of commit to following students through their whole high school career. And one of them got involved with someone online, eventually did tell her parents, but it consumed so much of her time, not just in the online relationship, but being private about it. And I think when Dana was talking about, it seems like parents just don't care, and their kids think that, it's really easy to start up relationships online and do it secretly. And I often say it, the best and the worst thing about the internet is access to information. You know, it's easy to be a predator, easier to be a predator, an online predator, and it's, so just the secrecy of relationship, and really false relationship, teens or younger even thinking that they really like this person, but they don't really even know this person, they haven't had any real contact, so that's what I meant by secrecy. And both ends, like the person they think they're talking to, there's a secrecy about that, because it's sometimes, I'm not saying that those relationships can't be, you know, come to fruition and be healthy and work, but when we're talking about teenagers and preteens, it's pretty scary. Carl.
It's kind of interesting because I came across this phrase a couple of years ago. Meant a lot at the time, and I'll contrast it in a second. phrase was this, the sentence was this: remember, your life is on a screen. On contrast to that, you know, if the Jesus story and if Scripture has any impact on the story that we supposedly live by as Christians or Lutherans, where is the bit about pick up your cross daily and follow me? Where is the bit about loving your neighbor as yourself and serving as in the mall giving us on Maundy Thursday? Those are diametrically opposed worlds. One is me focused, as my wife and I saw in a sense walking on the five or six Western Massachusetts college campuses, little action research. Between 8 and 9 out of 10 students walking together on a campus had a screen in front or on some corporate electric toilet. And the other thing is this thing about servants. Who are the models here behind us? You know, Teresa, St. Teresa, Mother Teresa, King. These were not self-absorbed, turned into one another creatures, human beings. They were out, focus on the other. These are two different worlds. And I guess one needs to choose which one you're going to be walking in.
I think, you know, on this point of secrecy, and I'll just kind of expand it to privacy in general, I think that the very piece you wrote, or you read, talks about Wendell Berry saying, well, there's a trade-off in all things, and I need to be actively questioning that. And I think one thing that my generation and generations below me, I don't think are, because we're growing up in that, we've grown up in that environment, we aren't really questioning what are the trade-offs here. When I have a Facebook account, or when I have an email, what are the trade-offs? What do I gain and what do I lose? And I think we stand to lose a lot. You know, one kind of silly example that I thought with Facebook is you have this opportunity to stay in touch with people who you otherwise would not. And I think that can be a very healthy and a great thing. But at the same time, it gives me some pause, because I think before I had that tool available, when it came time to say goodbye to somebody, that goodbye meant something, and it was meaningful, and it was certainly sad, but that, you know, I'm leaving Holden, and I don't know when I'll see you again. Maybe I won't. But now with Facebook, having a sense of, well, we'll stay in touch. So, you know, I think just being aware of that, but that's an added something to my life, and also being okay with ending of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I had that thought about a year ago, a little over a year ago. There was a guy, Pat, who was up here for 3 months, and he was a great guy. And I had a sense of, well, when it comes time to say goodbye, I could say, well, I'll find you on Facebook and we'll talk later. And I made a conscious choice not to. I said, take care, Pat. You know, goodbye. And I don't know if I'll see Pat again.
Did he mention?
I mean, we are friends on Facebook, but the point is
missing the point.
The point is that I was like, I'm not gonna pretend that I'm gonna try to stay in touch. And there's this tool available to us, and I don't think we're really
thinking. Well, and it's that whole what kind of connection are you really making? That's actually one of the questions I'm asking now as I think about my kids and my nieces and nephews and my sisters and other people, good friends, that's how we were connecting, was email and Facebook. So now, I love that you said that, because now I can think about what kind of connection do I want to make with them while I'm here? And not expect them necessarily to reciprocate, but what do I want to make with them?
Keep talking.
No, that's sort of that's what I said.
We can continue. I just want you to feel free to go to dinner.
I have to go.
You need to meet the kids. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You know,
and
it
if
is
you don't mind, you can take one of those if you don't mind.
Sure.
You don't have to.
Is Facebook a suitable replacement for true social interaction with people? I mean, you know, there's a difference between being with someone or seeing someone or setting something up and actually having a social face-to-face as compared to being glued to Facebook, you know, with 100 friends that you really kind of, you know, I'm not a real person on Facebook. I don't have 100 friends. You know, I think I got like 10. You know, and it's very few people that I'll actually even friend, because I don't really want that relationship. I want the interaction, the personal relationship, and I don't feel it's the same. And I see other people kind of glued to it, you know, like, and then of course they get them all emotionally involved and, you know, all that stuff, and it makes them disturbed.
Actually, I love Facebook.
Yeah.
I do too.
Totally love it, and the reason I got on it is because my niece went to Cape and Ray in England, and that was the way I could see her pictures. And the way I can connect with my nieces and nephews, that generation, is, I mean, it's wonderful. But we also have a deeper relationship besides Facebook.
The research on people with those, with the online connections, is not all negative.
Right.
No.
Yeah, there's positive aspects to it as well,
yeah.
To be sure.
Right. And I think that the way you phrase that is what's important. Is it a true replacement?
Yeah.
Supplement.
Certainly not. I mean, you know, people get on Facebook, you know, in high school, it's like, oh, let's see what's going on for the weekend. You know, before it was, you knew what was going on when you were at school, and people were there or they
right.
weren't. There wasn't this grand ambiguity or, you know, people feel like they're replacing hanging out, like
yeah,
chatting
yeah.
on Facebook. And I'll
right.
tell you, especially from the village, chatting on Facebook, you get to talk about like a quarter of one topic. And you're, you know, it's just, it's like pulling teeth to actually have a conversation.
Here in the village, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, especially.
Yeah.
But even still, like, the only reason I'm on Facebook is to instant message, whatever you call that, with a few people. But I almost hate it.
You know, we're all eternal on Facebook, too.
Yeah.
Because if somebody, I have several friends who have passed away. And
still have Facebook.
Every once in a while when I'm feeling kind of melancholy for them, I'll go back and I'll scroll through their pictures. It's kind of, that's kind of creepy, I know, but I put it. Yeah.
People keep posting to them.
Yeah, like when I'm thinking about somebody who passed away, and I know it's coming up on the anniversary, you know?
Yeah.
Some people post to those things.
Well, that's the other side of secrecy, the secrecy element that's in here is you can't have secrecy and secret things. But on the flip side, you know, nothing is secret, really, and everything has that potential to be brought out again. And, you know, in a conversation face-to-face, I say a lot of things, I process my thoughts out loud a lot. And so, in the conversation, you know, where I'm at and what I'm thinking and where I arrive at is going to develop and evolve over the course of the conversation. You know, I say stupid things, like, oh, you know, that's not what I meant, I'm sorry. And I can move on from that, but you write that or post that, and now it's there, you know?
I mean, let's take this interaction right here, for example. If we were doing this online, we would not have the same experience. You know, because you would have to type that in, or you have to wait for their voice to go to the server and then come back to you. So you're like waiting to respond, and then you're like, oh wait, I want to say something on that, and now that time has passed, and it's just, it's not nearly the same experience.
No. It's a different kind of communication.
It is, and that was part of my reason for not having a
I really
want to
hear
receptions.
So that Wendell Berry thing that you wrote or read at the beginning talks about evaluating why you need something and not just taking it because it's there.
Yeah.
Reminded me of when Steve Jobs came back to Apple. You know, Apple was, their stock was going down, the company was struggling, and Steve Jobs came back, and it was like, okay, he's going to resurrect the company, and he came out with the iPad. And I remember
iPod.
iPod, yes. I remember, so he's holding up this little thing, and it's like, that is going to
save Apple?
You know, what about a computer? Is this this little, you know, none of us ever had that before. There was nothing like that.
It did.
And it did. And all of a sudden, we all had to have it, or everybody, you know, and everybody's buying it. It's like, here's a product that nobody ever knew they
needed.
And there was no, there was no, again, there was no question about, well, do I really need that? It was like, no, I need that. That's like, you know. And
oh, we have lots of something my dad used to say to me when I'd come home with some, or I don't remember. He would just, like, coming home from a store or something, he's like, did you find something you couldn't live without?
Yeah. The other thing I liked about home, when you say something.
But I'm just saying that I think that, I mean, that to me, that was a, it's like, yeah, a lot of times we don't think about, or we don't ask the question, do I really need that, or how is it going to affect my life? It's just like, hey, it's the latest thing I got to have.
Right.
Look at it.
The other thing I really liked about his thing in there is he goes, I don't need a computer, I need more people.
Yeah.
And it made me think of Marty Haugen's Holden Prayer, and I didn't know until I came up here. I thought he wrote the whole thing, but I heard, and you guys correct me or not, but it was really a community effort. His name's on it, but it was this whole group of people that kept working on it, and the words and the music, isn't that true?
I would say
he
definitely wrote it, and he was the one that was in charge, but it was written in the community, and he got feedback, constant feedback, and so...
Kind of like Wendell Berry's the writer, but
he made the revision.
Yes.
The editor's report.
Yeah. So and what a community effort can do. I mean, it's an amazing piece of music, and Wendell Berry's an amazing writer.
And he also thought it was really written just for this community and never imagined that it would be...
worldwide.
You know, 30, what is it, 86, 96, 06... Yeah, it's almost going on almost 40 years.
Almost 30.
Almost 30, 27.
Sorry.
I was an English major.
The Holy Prayer.
Yeah.
When people leave that.
No, the
Holy
Prayer.
That's
so
good.
Vespers
86, the thing we do every Saturday night.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that it was, he never imagined that it would be used much outside of Holden.
Well, you want to talk about, like, we first started talking about not being aware of where we are and situations. And Chris brought the iPod. Instant. Put those earbuds in. You have no idea what's going on around us. You see so many people get those earbuds in them, you know, or, you know, their Bluetooth or whatever. I mean, that you put music in your ear, you can have it anywhere for hours on end.
Without disturbing
anybody
else.
And you have no idea what's going on.
But the thing that kind of was funny that happened to me when I was thinking about this, right before I came here, I was running errands and tying up loose ends, and I'd spent 3 weeks somewhere else in Washington, so I've really been gone a month. And I'm driving around, I stopped at a light, and of course I'm tweezing, because isn't the best light for tweezing when you're out in your car? I'm like tweezing my eyebrows.
Yeah.
I stop at a light,
and
I'm like, I'm self-conscious that someone's watching me tweeze my face. I look over, and they're both like this. I'm like, oh, tweeze, tweeze, tweeze. I go another light. It happened three times, and I'm like,